So good afternoon. It's a really great pleasure to be here after some period, some years came. But I would like to give to give this talk about quite recent results that were obtained with my colleagues. Sasha Katsevich from UCF and Marco Bertola, who is actually Canadian, from Concordia University. And so we the subject of this talk is this inversion formula for the Cauch-weighted Hilbert transform. So in a nutshell, this this transform appears when one study attenuated radon transform, which, for example, in spec. Next, is it this way? No, that's too much. Which appears in the single photon emission computed tomography. But I will not really. I didn't plan. Because that is a field where Sasha Katsevich is good in, so my side would be just inversion of this formula of this transform, and that's what I will be talking here. So the problem can be stated this way. So here is we have so the transform is question we denote it as H mu, where mu is a positive parameter. And so you see that's the definition of this of this transform. So it takes function f, which is defined on interval minus 1, 1, and transforms it into some g. And I notice the first typo that it should be perhaps x here, right? I would say most likely, yes. So that's so it's g of x. Right, and the question is reconstruction of the function f given the data. This is the measured data g, and we want to reconstruct this function f. So essentially, in a short, so what we can see, of course, and trivially observed, is that when the parameter mu equals to zero, then this Cauch disappears, and we have just a finite Hilbert transform. In this case, so what we will prove here that, and this finite Hilbert transform, which we denote H0 or H, it will be the same. Its properties, the properties of its of this transform, is quite known in the in various LP spaces, and our results will be exact extension of what is known for H0 to the case of H mu. So that's all. If you want to know what is this my talk about is to how to extend whatever we know for H sub 0, and we know pretty well, we understand pretty well behavior of the finite Hilbert transform in various LP. It will be different depending P is less than 2 or greater than 2, the behavior will be a little bit different. So whatever, and there are inversion formula, of course, for finite Hilbert and everything like that. So we just find similar things for the Cauch transform. And let me the mechanism that so the mathematics that is behind is the Riemann-Hilbert problem. So we will go into extent. Into complex plane, so most of the, although not all analysis done in the complex plane, then we'll have to return back on the interval minus 1, 1 and get whatever we need. So let me say a few words about what is known about this Cauch transform. So there was a paper of Rulgard back in 2004. Where there was an inversion formula, in fact, for H mu, but which was obtained with the help of distribution, and it could be computed numerically. However, it requires the data outside the support f. So f, function f, needed to be known on some interval j, which which contain minus 1, 1. So it require larger amount of data, and the formula was sort of not of the same nature that we will derive. Then there were some work about numerical inverting of the H mu that I have to mention, and also some other work of this nature. But that's all so far as we were concerned. So let me go and state the results that we had. So I will state three theorems. The first is the simplest. It says that basically the following: if your P is, we're talking about LP, right? Spaces, inversion formula in LP spaces. So if your P is between 1 and 2, then the null space is one dimensional, spanned by this function. Of course, if you put here mu equals 0, then this function will be 1 over square root, and that's exactly what we know happens in for finite Hilbert transform. If P is greater than 2, then null space is trivial. Now let's go one step more, and this is the second theorem. So now let's look at the inversion formula. Again, we consider two cases, P between 1 and 2, then the range of H mu is all LP, same as in the for finite Hilbert transform. And then the pseudo-inverse, because there is a null space, so that's certainly is pseudo-inverse, is given by this formula. So you see it's as explicit as possible. H means finite Hilbert transform, of course, and the inverse map is continuous. It's just LP. LP from minus 1, 1 to minus 1, 1. So it will be always on all spaces are living on minus 1, 1. Then in the case, so let's consider the second case when P is greater than 2, then the null space is trivial, but the range has a codimension. It has a codimension 1 and consists of all functions such that the integral is 0. The inverse now is given by this expression, which you can see it's similar. It's very similar to this, just this factor, the square root, inside the integral and outside the integral switches from being in the denominator here to numerator there, and vice versa. So that's the whole difference. Of course, that means this element belongs to LP, right? Because square root in the denominator is not a problem if P is less than 2, so that's not a problem. But over here it would be a problem. So therefore the inversion formula is such, and again this transformation is continuous, the inverse transformation. Now what happens in L2? As we know, the operator, even for finite Hilbert transform, is in L2 is not a Fredholm operator, and so the same stays for Cauch transform. And so what we found is the function is in the range if and only if there is a constant kappa such that this condition holds. Where formula, so we have two formulae for H inverse, so which one we use? We use the first one for P between 1 and 2. So again, this result is completely similar to what was obtained in 1991 by Akada and Elliot. So you see, so these are basic results, a part of some fancy way of parameterizing the inverses that I will, if time permit, I will talk at the very end. So these are the results. So essentially, again, it says that we can extend to Cauch transform more or less whatever we know, whatever facts are there for just finite Hilbert transform. Okay, so now, so since my results are already presented, so I can relax a little bit and go slowly through some facts of how we obtain these results. As I said, it will be there will Riemann-Hilbert problems would be involved in essential way, and complex analysis will be used. I will review a little bit Sachotsky-Plemiel formula for scalar Riemann-Hilbert problem from finite Hilbert transform. Then I would go to Kosh transform this problem one, and I will set it as a vector Riemann-Hilbert problem, non-homogeneous vector Riemann-Hilbert problem. Then we'll discuss the null space, and then we'll obtain two inversion formula in some nice space. For example, in the space of Hölder continuous functions. Hölder continuous is easier to work because all the singular integrals then exist and in a standard sense. And then we go from Hölder continuous functions to LT. And at the end, we'll show that in L2, this transformation is not Fredholm, and describe the range. And finally, this two-parameter family of inversion will also be shown. Okay, so that's to relax. And now, the results are there, so I'm just remind the basic facts about Cauchy operator. Now we're in the complex plane. So let gamma be some simple oriented contour in complex plane, and psi be a Hölder continuous complex valued function on the contour. Then the Cauchy operator is defined like that. And this Cauchy operator basically solves the following Riemann-Hilbert problem. So you say, okay, along this contour gamma, I'm looking for function phi that satisfies this jump condition along the contour gamma that has the prescribed behavior at infinity, namely it vanishes, and is analytic everywhere except gamma. Right? So then solution, this phi is given by this Cauchy operator. Okay, so actually the Sachotsky-Plemiel formula can be conveniently written in this way. So the difference C plus minus C minus is identity, and the sum C plus plus C minus, if we understand by our gamma, this contour minus 1, 1 is simply minus I times the finite Hilbert times the finite Hilbert transform. Okay, so this is these facts are very, very well known. Let me mention that this signs plus and minus, I mean limiting the contour is oriented. So by plus and minus, I mean limited values from the left and from the right of the contour in the standard way. And please, if there are questions, I would be, please don't hesitate to interrupt. Okay, so now I would like to show a little bit to how we play to prove, for example, inversion formula for the finite Hilbert transform. Of course, there is no novelty here whatsoever, but just to show how thing works. When everything is simple because the problem is scalar, a Riemann-Hilbert problem is scalar. So one can start with this equation. So we need to solve for f, assuming g is given. So everything f and g are real valued function. Well, f we don't know, but g is some function given on the interval minus 1, 1. So I can rewrite this equation by in this way, because of this relation between Cauchy operators and finite Hilbert transform, right? So I can rewrite this this equation this way. And then what I will do, I will introduce this radical r and divide by this radical. So probably I guess I choose the wrong sign here. It should be 1 minus z square, but I guess it doesn't matter so far for this calculation. So then I get this equation, then I divide by r plus both sides, it's still okay. Then I notice that when we talk about this radical, the branch cut, the branch points are plus minus 1, the branch cut we put on this interval minus 1, 1, so there are two sides, and therefore r plus here means that I take upper side, let's say, one side of the along the branch cut. So if we go on the other side, going from r plus to r minus, we'll change the sign of r. So therefore, if I this term here, I can write in this way. If I write this f over r minus, so the sign changes from plus to minus, and we got this equation. Now it's a difference, right, of limiting values from the right and from the left. So by the Sachotsky-Plemiel formula, I immediately write solution as f of z. Now f of z is now living outside the cut branch cut minus 1 1, right? So and then this is the formula for the solution. There c means this Cauchy transform. So now how I get, I want to reconstruct f on the interval minus 1, 1. So for this aim, I take the sum of the limiting values, f plus and f minus, and then I will obtain this formula, right? Because it will be c plus plus c minus, right? So it will give me this this formula. And now the last line is a simple calculation that if I apply h, the finite Hilbert transform to this f, I will indeed get g, right? So it's basically manipulation with these two identities. I'm just manipulating with them, and so now within the class, if I want solution f to be such that the limiting values are in L2, so then the solution is unique. Okay. So that's to warm up to Riemann-Hilbert problem. Now let's go to more serious things. So now I would like to go back to my original problem where it has, so that is the transformation. So we have extra cosh here. So I will now define Q as basically this integral, but I will put in the denominator 2 pi I. So that is Q. Q capital is just something like Cauchy operator of whatever is inside. And it's defined, of course, for z outside the interval minus 1, 1. And then the equation that we have, this, which I now want to write minus I h sub mu of f equals minus I g, right? I can write it this operator. I can write in this form. So it's just the same equation. Function g is given. I want to find f. I write it this way. Now let's observe that using well-known properties of cosine hyperbolic, that q can be, of course, written as a difference of cosh outside, cosh inside, minus sinh outside, sinh inside. Right? Okay. So far, so good. I would like use this representation and stack it into this equation. So for this, let's denote. So you see, in this integral, I have what? I have a finite, I have a Cauchy transform. This integral over 2 pi I is a Cauchy transform of not of f, but of product f times cosh. So I denote f sub c Cauchy transform of this, and f sub sine Cauchy transform, or f sub s Cauchy transform of that. And then this equation will be what? It will be cosine hyperbolic times fc plus plus f sub c plus plus f of c sub c minus minus similar things for here. So now this equation using this representation of Cauch and using this notations I can write in this form. So now my unknowns are f sub function f sub c and f sub s, but these two functions are not independent. Of course, they somehow related, right? Because one is just f times Cauch and the other is f times inch. And how this related shown this equation is responsible of how they are related. Because if I subtract f sub c plus minus f sub c minus, right, by the Plumel formula, it will be just Cauch times f. So I have sinh Cauch times f minus Cauch sinh times f. Of course, it will be zero. So I got these two equations. What happens at the endpoints? Let's see. You mean limiting behavior, because Q is so. What sort of limiting behavior is there? So it depends, of course, what how f behaves. But normally, if f is like a constant, let's say, then it will be logarithmic, like that sort of logarithmic behavior at the endpoints. If f has worse than constant behavior, like some negative power of z minus 1, then it will be negative power, but between 0 and minus 1, then it will be the same. Then it will be the same behavior, the same power behavior. Okay, so now I'm ready to state. So before machinery start to work, I need to set some Riemann-Hilbert problem. So again, raw material are these two equations. And so I introduce the vector function f. It's a row vector f, which consists of these two unknown functions f sub c and f sub s. And based on this equation, here is the corresponding Riemann-Hilbert problem. So I want f of z to be analytic outside the interval. It should satisfy jump conditions f plus equals f minus times some matrix m plus g, where g is this vector, which we pull. The vector g is obtained from this vector. Vector g is this one, and the jump matrix m is this matrix. This jump condition is obtained from these two equations. If one do a little bit calculations, which I decided not to bore the audience with, so this couple of equations will go into this Riemann-Hilbert problem, and we have the requirement that f of z capital behaves like 1 over z at infinity. Now that simply follows because if you look how like Cauchy transform behaves at infinity, so you have in the denominator of Cauchy transform you have zeta minus z, so everything is bounded, z goes to infinity, so we have 1 over z behavior. And finally, that needs to be explained a little bit, but for now on, that's good enough for us. So we allow or require the endpoint behavior of this sort. It's like minus 1 plus little power, minus 1 plus little epsilon at the endpoints. So that is the Riemann-Hilbert problem which we want to solve. Which f? This f? This one?
You said something about the Q,
Q is actually not. No, but that is, you see, that is, so this F is, so this cosh is inside the integral. So we integrate only from minus 1 to 1. Okay, so we want to solve the non-homogeneous vector Riemann-Hilbert problem. As often happens, if you want to solve something non-homogeneous, you first need to solve something homogeneous. So therefore, I will state the auxiliary problem, auxiliary homogeneous problem, and that is this problem. So now we want to find a matrix function, 2x2 matrix function gamma, which is analytic outside the minus 1, 1, satisfy homogeneous jump condition, and has the same behavior at infinity, the same identity plus O small of z minus 1, so it's identity behavior at infinity, and have similar behavior at the endpoints. So we want to solve this. Okay, so if we solve this, if we find gamma, what good it will do for us in solving the non-homogeneous Riemann-Hilbert problem? This fact is shown here. So if we happen to solve the matrix Riemann-Hilbert problem and then invert the solution, and this inverse will also satisfy the endpoint conditions, which we will check later that this is indeed the case, then f of z obtained as a Cauchy transform of this product times gamma satisfies all the requirements for the vector Riemann-Hilbert problem. It's called 5. Unfortunately, numeration didn't show on my slides, but this is vector Riemann-Hilbert problem. Okay, this is a simple fact, which the proof is one line, so we can actually see how it goes. So it's pretty similar as always when you have a non-homogeneous system, solution to the homogeneous system helps you to find solution. So F plus will be equal to C plus of whatever argument we have here and times gamma plus, right? So you're on one side of the cut, so everything has to have pluses. And now, so C plus, as we know from the Plamel formula, is C minus plus whatever is inside, because the difference is identity operator, right? So this C plus is replaced by this expression, and gamma plus is there. Now, what I will do, I will distribute gamma plus here, and because gamma plus satisfies the matrix Riemann-Hilbert problem, it can be replaced by gamma minus M, right? And then gamma plus here and gamma plus inverse here cancel. So we will have now, please notice that this expression, C minus of whatever is inside times gamma minus is just F minus. So we got this expression, so we solved, that is indeed solution of the vector Riemann-Hilbert problem. Okay, so that's good. So now the question is, so apparently if we can solve matrix Riemann-Hilbert problem, we can solve vector Riemann-Hilbert problem. If we can solve vector Riemann-Hilbert problem and find F capital, we can extract F small, so then take the limiting values, and that will be, at the limiting values, that will be our solution. Okay, so on the next slide, we talk about solving the matrix Riemann-Hilbert problem. So some reminder of the Pauli notations, we wouldn't need them much, and the identity matrix is that. So then it's a simple fact that the solution, one of the solutions of the matrix Riemann-Hilbert problem has this form, which more visually can be written this way, right? So this matrix of cosine and sine hyperbolic, where beta is this square root and r is this difference. So that is a solution of the Riemann-Hilbert problem. That was a little bit tricky to find, but once you guess it, just plug in and check that it works. Right? So as at the end, we will find the general solution of the Riemann-Hilbert problem, and that will produce the two-parameter, the larger, family of inversion formula. But of course, because the null space is one-dimensional, if there is null space, so it can be 1,000-parameter inversion formula, but the difference always proportional to the element of non-trivial element of the null space. Okay, so but so far we just observe that this is a solution of the Riemann-Hilbert problem. We can check matrix Riemann-Hilbert problem. It's easy to work with this guy, and it satisfies all the properties that all the requirements that were made here. In particular, we can calculate gamma inverse, just inverting matrices which were there. We see the shape of the solution, and we can check that it satisfies the requirements for the boundary behavior at the points -1 and 1. So now this using this gamma and gamma inverse, the formula here now is correct, because we can check this solution by hand. This condition, the endpoint condition for gamma inverse, we can check by hand. Okay, so that was preparation for the for obtaining further results. And now let's first look closely at the very first theorem, that the statement about the null spaces. Okay, so it's just a reminder. So in the finite Hilbert transform case, it is well known that the function, the element of null, non-trivial element of null space is this when in LP, when P is between 1 and 2. Okay, so we will to obtain the corresponding results for our cost transform H mu, we need basically two propositions. I just formulate these propositions. I wouldn't prove them, but proof is relatively not difficult. So here is the fact. If we assume that C is element of the null space in LP, where P is between 1 and 2, then it has to have this form, some entire function in the complex plane divided by the square root. So that's the statement. And if it is if P is between 2 and infinity, including 2, then it should be entire function times this radical. Okay, so that's statement proposition number one that is useful. Now the other proposition is stems from the following observation. So if we're looking for f from the null space, and then we form vector fc fs with this f. So you just multiply by cosh this f by cosh and by sinh, and take a Cauchy transform, right, that to get this vector. Then, of course, it will satisfy the equation f plus equals f minus times m plus g. But g will be zero, because that the f is from the null space. So it satisfies the homogeneous equation, naturally. it also satisfies this normalization at infinity. It should be O capital of z minus 1. Therefore, if we just take rows of solution of our matrix problem, that wouldn't, it certainly satisfies this equation, but not the normalization. So it wouldn't be good. However, if we take two different solutions, right? So gamma at infinity has normalization identity matrix plus something of order z to the power minus 1. If we subtract them, then the difference will be of this order and will satisfy the same equation. So this is our chance to get the corresponding f, and then to extract a function from the null space. So to So the following proposition allow us to make the next step on this approach. So namely, we say that if gamma tilde is another solution of the same matrix Riemann-Hilbert problem. So, and if U is the ratio of gamma inverse and our gamma, right, by ratio I mean this product, then it must have this form where A and B are constant matrices. And this form simply follows because we request certain behavior of gamma tilde and gamma inverse at the endpoints. Then this fact follows from the endpoint restriction. Again, I'm not giving the proof, but this is just a step. So if you want the difference between gamma tilde and gamma inverse, so you multiply U by gamma, and it will be, so U multiplied by this gamma, it will be gamma plus something equals gamma tilde. So the difference is this basically two terms. Okay, now, following this idea, we can calculate this F, which is a Cauchy transform of the vector Cauch sinh times element of the null space. We can calculate it explicitly using the previous proposition. And now, once we know F, so to extract phi, that's simply the formula, right? Because this difference will give you cosh mu of z times phi, so you get cosh square times phi minus sinh square times phi gives you phi, basically, because cosh square minus sinh square is one. So here is the expression that we get, and that is a proof of the first theorem, that the null space, the function from the null space has this form. Okay, so let's go to the next. We want to work on inversion formula, but now it is the work of inversion formula is simply calculation. Again, I want to remind that we are not working so far. We are not working in any LP. We are working, so all our singular integrals, and any time we have Cauchy transform, we have a singular integral. All if we take limiting value, so all functions are as nice and smooth as we need. For example, a Hilbert continuous is good enough. So what we know now? We know that F is the Cauchy transform of vector G times this matrix and multiplied by matrix gamma. We know that gamma has an exact form, and we know that to get F, that's what we need to do. Right? So that's the for if knowing F capital to extract small f to solve our problem, that's the formula. So if we do all the calculations, so basically we know everything now. So after some calculations, we arrive with this inversion formula. In this inversion formula, you see this is the finite Hilbert transform, and over here is the inverse finite Hilbert transform. Now we denote H inverse left and H inverse right by the condition that there are no singularity at the left or there are no singularity in the right as shown by this formula. So H inverse LR are simply these expressions. If you look at this expression, you see integral is a finite number. So there is a square root singularity at the left end, but not on the right end. So sorry, I misspoke. HL means that singularity is on the left, and HR means that singularity is on the right. And singularity is like 1 over square root singularity, right? So here is the explicit formula for the Cauchy transform. However, we are not talking yet about any LP spaces. We are assuming that F was Hölder continuous, so then G will be Hölder continuous, and then for this F and G, so that would be the transform. Okay, let me move down, and so now I would like to look a little bit at this. So how should we interpret the fact that we have two different inverse transforms? One has singularity in the left end, and the other has singularity in the right end. So what happens, for example, if I take the difference of two transforms? Well, if I have the difference of these two transforms, for example, right inverse minus left inverse, direct calculations show that what I get will be proportional to this function from the null space, which I denoted V sub mu, times some constant, and the constant is simply this integral, right, of the product V sub mu times G. Okay, so then if we look here, we can observe that the following three conditions are equivalent. So the following three statements are equivalent. One statement is that both left inverse and right inverse are bounded. We know that normally they are not bounded. Left inverse has square root singularity on the left end, right inverse has singularity on the right end. And of course, Vm has, we know exactly, it's Cauchy divided by the square root, it has singularities on the both ends. But so the two will be bounded, that's equivalent to say if they are bounded, so that means that this coefficient is zero, and that means that left inverse equals to the right inverse. So if you choose element, if your data is so nice that it is orthogonal in a sense to this function v mu, then the left inverse and right inverse are coincide essentially, and there are no singularities. Okay, and then these two inverse functions in fact give you the same. So this is to recap what I said, that singularities of inversion disappears if G satisfies this condition, and we will show below that this condition is in fact the range condition for H mu in LP when P is greater than 2. Okay, so in the next step, now I want to talk a little bit about what happens in LP space. So far, the constructions were when we assume that F and G are nice enough functions. So now I want to go to LP. So there are some notations. So we consider X a Banach space, and LX is a space of linear continuous operators. And the operator for Fredholm operator, we denote two numbers, alpha of A, it's the dimension of the null space, and beta of A is the dimension of the null space of adjoint operator. Right? And then the index will be just the difference. And now I will use some known facts. So first of all, if we consider a finite Hilbert transform, right? So what is known? Well, it's known that it is a Fredholm operator in LP when P is different from 2 and otherwise on this interval. And moreover, we have information about the dimensions of null space of A and A conjugated, right? So in the case P equals P between 1 and 2, and in the case P is greater than 2. Okay. The second fact is that if we take the difference, and well, that is a known fact. Now that is something which comes naturally, if you take the difference between h mu and h zero, so how you take the difference? You will have essentially in the denominators, so inside the integral, so both are integral, this and this are some singular integrals, but here in the denominator is cosh, in the numerator, I'm sorry, and here is 1. So if you take cosh minus 1, you will get sinh of half argument or something like that, and then you will see that this operator is not singular anymore. So that's how one can show that k is a compact operator in this case. Now, we have already shown that for operator h mu, we already in the previous slides, we already calculated that the dimension of the null space is 1 if p is between 1 and 2, and trivial if p is greater than 2. It's enough just to look at this function v, where it is, here to see that it belongs to LP when p is less than 2, but doesn't belong when p is 2 or greater. Okay, so now some more additional facts that are so from this we can deduce the following, that because the difference is compact and h0 is Fredholm, so h mu will also be Fredholm, and secondly h and h mu will have the same index. So two facts we can derive from operator theory. So now, because if indices are the same and alphas are the same for h and h mu, so then the betas should be the same. So, and from here we derive that the beta also are the same. In particular, it means that that h mu maps on the whole LP if p is less than between 1 and 2, and there is space of codimension 1 to the range of h mu if p is greater than 2. Okay. So from here on we can deduce that that the range condition for h mu in LP when p is greater than 2 is that it should be orthogonal, so it should be orthogonal to this function v sub mu. Now for different so now let's talk about, so that's how we describe the range of the operators h of mu. Now let's derive convenient inversion formula. I already derived left and right inverse, but they have singularities generically. There will be singularity either on the right end or on the left end. Now, when we talk about LP, we don't care so much about singularities. What we care is if the inverse is an LP or is not. So therefore, we can take the formulae we get before, and just by subtracting or adding the element of null space, we can deform the, we can, and after some calculations, we obtain one formula that is good for H, for LP when P is between 1 and 2, because then the square root is not, in the denominator is not a problem. Of course, if P is greater than 2, then this because of this denominator, this inverse wouldn't be in the corresponding LP, but then we can derive similar formula just, replacing the square root outside will go in the numerator, and the square root inside will go into the denominator. Right, and so that is the other inversion formula. So that is, as I said, that's pretty similar to what we have in the case of just Hilbert transform. Now, what else can be said? Now my time is running out, but I have only a few slides left. So now I want to mention, I mentioned at the beginning that if we have a if we take a general solution of the matrix Riemann-Hilbert problem, then we can obtain some different form of the different forms of the inverse of the inversion. So, and these are some steps to obtain the most general solution of the matrix Riemann-Hilbert problem. So I start, if you have a matrix Riemann-Hilbert problem, homogeneous matrix Riemann-Hilbert problem, then automatically for the, and I'm talking about quadratic square matrices, so then it gives you a scalar Riemann-Hilbert problem for its determinant, right? So you can see, I even didn't write it here, but solving this problem for the determinant of G, we observe that the determinant has this form where T is any complex number. And solution, of course, we need to worry that solution is, if you don't worry that the matrix is invertible in the whole complex plane, then all this, any value of this T parameter T is good. But if you want gamma to be invertible outside the interval, and I mean this not curly brackets, of course, but square brackets, then T should be either 0 or 1. Okay, but taking this determinant, and then we can, so one parameter, one free parameter is sitting inside the determinant when we're choosing the matrix solution. Another free parameter comes, and this parameter is called alpha, comes when you solve the matrix Riemann-Hilbert problem. Solution has, as you can see, similar form, and perhaps here it should be R, if I remember correctly, there should be this difference between Z minus square root inside, it disappeared, sadly enough, right? So it's not a constant matrix by no means. Z is sitting here, it's just disappeared. So that is the most general solution of the Riemann-Hilbert of the matrix Riemann-Hilbert problem. Now, using this most general solution, we can obtain the most general inversion formula. And now you see the inversion, now it's two-parameter family of inversions. And it's written explicitly here, where, so it's a twice Hilbert transform is taken. But there are this kappa is the cosine of this, sigma is sine of mu times square root, and a is this interval. So you can say that so t is any parameter, t is anything which is outside the interval, should be minus 1 1, I'm sorry, t should be outside minus 1 1, and alpha is any complex number. Now, of course, in this case, if you take the difference of two such, so take any alpha t and beta s, and one can calculate that it is, as it should be, proportional to the element of the null space. It, of course, otherwise it would be too bad. And also, it is actually possible to identify. So, in the past, we have a specific solution. For example, left inverse and right inverse. So, left inverse will correspond to this. Right inverse will correspond to that. And one of the and inverse for LP when p is between 1 and 2 is actually corresponds to the limit when t equals to infinity. The other inverse, surprisingly, for p greater than 2, we couldn't get easily from this expression. So I guess I'm at the end, and thank you very much for being so patient.
I wish. So far, no. Because